This is Christopher, and you are listening to Orphan Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain media. Comforting me on this freaky February episode are the brave and hopefully alive Lydia and Barry. Welcome, you guys.
Ooh.
Well, let's get into that.
We are going to be discussing the 1962 independent film Carnival of Souls.
Yeah.
Yes.
Carnival.
Written by John Clifford, directed by Herc Harvey, and starring Candace Hillegass. A box office failure in 1962, it has since gained cult film status and is regarded as an early example of psychological horror. This film was shot for a reported $33,000, which works out to be about $250,000 in today's money. And it was all done in 3 weeks, shot in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Lawrence, Kansas. Clifford and Harvey were employees of Centron Studios. Now, this studio was a production company that specialized in industrial and educational films. And Carnival of Souls marks the first and last feature film for these two. This film was suggested by Barry, and I cannot thank him enough for doing so.
Oh, thank you.
This was an awesome watch. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, this is the first time I've seen the film. I've heard the title once or twice, but I never really sought it out. So it was really cool. Being a fan of the kind of the independent film in general, and of course liking a lot of independent horror films and everything. So it was very cool. And this may be the earliest that I've seen independent film, and certainly one of the best that I've seen.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm so glad you liked it.
Lydia, have you seen this one before this?
Not before this.
No.
No.
Okay. Had you heard of it before? Had you ever heard of it at all?
No, the closest I've gotten was, I think, was it Kiss that did the album? I'm looking. I believe it. Kiss was the artist on the album Carnival of Souls.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Yeah, there we go. I found it. And yes, that is correct.
Okay, so your knowledge of Carnival of Souls is through Kiss.
No, well, let's say I knew that there was an album out there called Carnival of Souls. And I honestly was not aware of a movie, but, you know, now I am.
Okay,
I've seen
gotcha.
It now.
So, Barry, how did you come across this film?
I'd heard it mentioned alongside movies like The Sixth Sense and Night of the Living Dead, just being the essential low-budget horror films where the horror is, as you mentioned, strictly psychological, where it really is a movie that kind of relies on shadow and suggestion more than gore than anything. It's just one of these films I'd heard about, and once I finally got around to watching it, it just occurred to me that there are so many films that are obviously inspired from it, not only that you'll probably mention, like David Lynch and Romero, but also obviously any film by M. Night Shyamalan can be charted as being influenced by this movie.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think he saw this is, pretty much sums up M. Night Shyamalan's entire filmography.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
Well, should we get into this film a little bit?
Let's do it.
I was a little hesitant. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to really sit down and take notes on the plot of this film, because it's one of these movies where I kept finding myself having to stop it and go back because I just kind of kept getting sucked into it and I wasn't jotting anything down. It's visually a really awesome thing to see.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's fun that this film was made so cheaply, and yet it finds like these locales in Lawrence, Kansas, of all places, in that amazing, amazing temple in Salt Lake City, and makes them look so positively dreamlike and beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to begin with this film, we see three girls out for a drive, and they start racing with another car, and they end up sharing a one-lane bridge and get knocked off the bridge into the river. And at this point, we get really one of the most impressive little credit scenes for this time, for this era, I think, that I've ever seen. All the credits are shot. We're so used to even all the films that we've kind of reviewed on this podcast, for the most part, have been practically just, you know, title cards in front of the camera. And we're talking films that took place 10, 20 years after this. This one, all the credits are done sort of in line and floating on the water, on the muddy river, or sort of hugging the flotsam and the shoreline.
Yeah.
Really loved it. Yeah,
so cool.
Very cool.
This movie
really
and the other film that does that, Speed 2, Cruise Control.
Nice.
Obviously also inspired by Carnival of Soul.
Yeah, you can see the influence there very clearly.
Oh, absolutely. Well, after the credits roll, it's hours later, and the authorities are still looking for the car. They're, you know, throwing lines into the water. The water is apparently really high, and the current's strong. They don't think they're ever going to find it. And at this point, we also hear the guys from the other car telling the police officer they're pretty much lying about how the thing happened, which I kind of immediately being that they were talking souls and this and that. And then shortly thereafter, one of the girls comes stumbling out of the water. Again, like I said, this is supposed to be hours after the car has gone into the thing. And I thought, whoa, this is going to be some sort of, Back from the Dead revenge flick. Didn't turn out that way. In fact, we never see the kids that drove them off the bridge again.
Yeah.
But you do talk about the influences that this movie, the other movies, you know, came out of this. And you can see there's a moment. Oh, I'm sorry. Keep going. When we get to the moment, I'll talk about it.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, yes. Yeah, so the girl stumbles out. This is Candace Hillegas as Mary. She stumbles out of the water. They ask her if she knows anything about the other girls, but she has no memory of it.
Well, and that is actually the moment that I was thinking of. When she comes out of the water, she looks so much like Carrie to me. Like, she's just drenched in the mud and all of that. I had a total flashback to Carrie when, you know, just with that one shot. But instead of being blood, it's mud.
There's actually a shot that takes place. Yeah, I think it's right after she stumbles out of the water, and we see a shot that's taken from behind her, as if you're kind of looking up from the river. And the bridge is at this really odd angle, and all you see is you see her is in silhouette, and the bridge is almost a silhouette against this really kind of dark, almost stormy-looking sky. And it's a brilliant shot. It's kind of one of those shots where you wish you could have a print of because you want to hang it on the wall.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth noting that Mary, even though she doesn't seem like exactly the most fun individual, she seems completely devoid of life and sucked of joy when she emerges from that river.
I found it interesting, and it's something that you see throughout this film. I was going to comment on that, is it's a fantastic casting choice. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but yeah, she's not a woman. You would expect her from this is going to be a woman that's got this new lease on life and, you know, or something. And she doesn't. Like, you put it incredibly well, just sucked of life. Her face is emotionless through most of this film.
Yeah.
And she talks in almost sort of a deadpan manner. And it's all kind of like, I don't care, whatever. And it really works well. I don't know if that was intentional, if that's just the actress, if that was a directorial choice. But it works really well for the film.
Yeah, and I think when we get to the ending, we could discuss whether that was an intentional choice or not. That might have a bearing to ultimately what the plan of the film is, but it's open to interpretation, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we flash forward to a few days later, and we see Mary back on the bridge, but now she's all cleaned up. And she's looking down into the water. They're still looking for this car. She goes to her own car and reaches for, I think, the radio knob, and we do a quick flash to her playing the pipe organ. And right here, I want to say that I love some of the transitions that are in this film from one scene to another. The cut scenes.
Yeah.
The cut transitions. She goes right from the stereo knob, well, probably the AM knob in her car.
Right,
and it flashes to immediately to her to a knob on this pipe organ. And again, this is another brilliant image because you're looking down on her playing this pipe organ. This pipe organ is exposed. It's in a warehouse. It's not installed in a church. And it's a really neat because you don't often see something like this in that state. So it just makes for this really interesting look, seeing all the, you know, all the pipes all surrounding her up almost in and itself a cathedral. Well, we learn that she is a very gifted player. This is apparently a place where they either construct or repair pipe organs.
Hello? Is this like the one I'll be playing in Utah?
It's quite similar. I supervised the installation myself. The accident won't delay your going, will it?
No. I'm leaving this morning. There's nothing I can do here.
That's right. Well, Mary, you'll make a fine organist for that church. Be very satisfying to you, I think.
It's just a job to me.
Well, it's not quite the attitude for going into church work.
I'm not taking the vows. I'm only going to play the organ.
Oh, want more than that? Of course, it doesn't pay much, but, well, at least it's a start. Are you driving by Benton to see your folks?
No, I can't. I must hurry. I've got to leave. I'm going to drive straight through.
Mary, it takes more than intellect to be a musician. Put your soul into it a little. Okay? Good luck, Mary. Stop by and see us the next time you're in.
Thank you. But I'm never coming back.
I don't know about that girl.
How do you mean?
Day before yesterday, she was the only one of three girls to survive an accident. You'd think she'd feel a little something like humbleness or gratitude.
Never know what she thinks. She's always kept pretty much to herself.
Yeah, maybe in her place I'd do the same thing. Just pick up life again.
Well, she's so quiet-like, she fools you. But she's a tough-minded little thing.
I guess that's what it takes to survive. But I still say she's behaving strangely.
Well, if she's got a problem, it'll go right along with her.
Yep.
During the drive, she decides to drive straight through. And during the drive, she's, you know, of course, tunes in some music. And we get an earful of some very strange organ music that Mary can't seem to actually turn off. It just keeps playing no matter how much she turns the knob or anything. Eventually, she just gives up. And I think at that point is when she starts noticing the building on the horizon, which is this just a large, ominous shape. Unfortunately, you can't really make out what she's looking at it. At this point in the film, you just see this odd shape on the horizon, but the organ music and everything, you know, it's something foreboding and something mysterious.
And I guess it's worth noting that the film itself has been scored by a pipe organ, probably arguably the only film to ever be scored by a traditional church pipe organ.
Yeah, absolutely. I was saying we hear this odd, strange pipe organ music as she's driving, but you're right. The rest of the film, any incidental music, any music that's played throughout the film, it is a pipe organ.
That's something that, I mean, you notice it when they're making a point of it, but I hadn't actually picked that out.
I think we get our first appearance of the ghoul, who will play a very important role through the rest of the film. We first see him in the reflection in the passenger window. Also, another great little trickery camera trick, post-production trick, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a great shot. I love it, too, because as she's driving, you first can see her, like, from the glow of the radio hitting the side of her face. You see her reflection in it first, so it kind of draws your attention there. And then, you know, she looks and does a double take when he appears.
Yeah, exactly.
But I like how it leads into it. There's not just randomly a face there. You kind of get the impression that it would be normal to see a reflection, so when it's not hers, it's doubly startling.
Yeah, especially because we see, you know, her profile in reflection, as you should do. In his reflection, it's if he's standing outside the car as the car is moving, and he's looking straight in, and it makes it really eerie. Yes.
Yeah, this is a total creep fest, kids. what could I say? I mean, decades later, there was a movie called Ghost Story, which had this very famous effect of a car driving into a ghoul. And the ghoul was played by Alice Creege, the Borg Queen in Star Trek First Contact. And even so, that effect wasn't anywhere near as creepy as the way it's done in Carnival of Souls. And I think it might have something to do with it being in black and white. And there's also something to do with it just being late at night. And it's just this woman all by herself. And this face is just constantly hounding her while she's driving. It's very, very creepy, nightmarish stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at this point, I meant to say this earlier. People, if you haven't seen this film, I mean, unfortunately, we can't discuss it without spoiling it. And I really... would recommend you going and watching the movie before you get completely spoiled by us talking about it.
And then come back and listen to us.
Then come back and listen, exactly. Well, when we see this ghoul, he's in the middle of the road, and she swerves to miss him, and ends up driving right off the road into a ditch. But she does manage to get the car up out of the ditch and continues on her way. And she finally makes it to this town. She pulls in to get some gasoline, and she gets a little bit of history of the building that she was seeing from the gas station attendant. Apparently, this was, in this movie, used to be a bathhouse along the Salt Lake. But as the water receded, the bathhouse moved out, and he said that eventually tried to turn it into a dance hall, I think, for a while, and then eventually some sort of carnival tried to move in, but it's just been sitting there vacant for years.
Well, and there's something, too, I think that's interesting in this part that you probably don't really notice, and I think it goes to show how understated a lot of the movie is. She, you know, gets out of the car as the attendant is pumping her gas, and she walks around, and she just, like, kind of surreptitiously checks the door handle, checks the window, you know, everything
yeah.
where the guy was. And it's not something, you know, now we have a tendency to see in films where people really overdo it. You know, they go and they run around and they jerk on the door handle. It's just so overplayed. But, you know, I love the way that it's subtle in this. It's
yeah, absolutely.
It's not overkill.
And again, another fantastic transition. I don't know. It's the little things that amuse me and that I love so much. It's she asks for this address. Do you know where this boarding house is? He's like, oh, yeah, that's right up here. And he walks and he points to the screen, and then the screen goes blank and she's at the boarding house. And I don't know why. I just love it. It's just some may call it a cop out or some may call it cheap, but I just love the fact we don't need to see her driving the whole way. We don't need to hear him. You go left and then you turn right. It's just, oh, point this way and watch the screen kind of go blank as he kind of blocks the camera almost, and then you're at where she was asking. I loved it.
It's very smart editing.
Well, she moves into this boarding house, and we meet her landlady, Mrs. Thomas, who seems to be a nice little lady. And then I think we go right to the first day in the job at the church, where, again, she plays heavenly. She plays the pipe organ. And we do, I think, see the ghoul lurking about the church or outside the church. I don't think Mary sees him, but she does kind of get this odd feeling and quits playing and starts staring out the window. Kind of, I think we're supposed to assume it's in the direction of the large building off the road. Well, the minister notices this and speaks to her for a while and offers to drive her out to check the place out. So she goes ahead and goes with him.
This used to be quite a place. It's been deserted for a long time now.
Will you take me in?
My goodness, no. It isn't safe out there anymore. That's why they put up this barrier.
It'd be very easy to step around it.
What attraction could there be for you out there?
I'm not sure. I'm a reasonable person. I don't know. Maybe I want to satisfy myself that the place is nothing more than it appears to be. Would you take me out there?
No. The law has placed it off limits. Wouldn't be very seemly for a minister to break the law, would it?
No. Maybe I can come back some other time.
Shall we go along now?
And I like that she's just pretty much oblivious to the fact that he finds it rather rude and kind of just wrong of her. It's like, oh, I'll just come back another time. And he's okay. She plays herself. She's a very odd, strange person throughout this film.
Yeah.
Well, after a nice bath, Mary meets her neighbor, John. Now, John is the most unlikable guy that I think I've seen in a film in a long time. This guy is just pure creep through and through.
I'm trying to remember. I saw something recently. I wish I could remember what it was. The character reminds me of him, but this is the original creepy guy on screen, I think. He's not evil. He's just kind of a creepy jerk.
Yeah. Was the film you just recently saw, did it have anything to do with like a serial rapist or something? I think this guy is just one step away.
Yeah, I agree with you both. I'm currently teaching my film students about, we're dealing with 80s teen sex comedies. And we were talking about, I mentioned as an example, the movie Private School, in which the teen boys in those movies, they seem so horny, they're downright deranged. And I would describe that character in the same way. I feel like John, he's horny to a level where it seems downright psychotic and obsessive.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah, very. And what I love is the fact that he just cannot understand why she's not into him. I mean, he's practically forcing himself into her room. She's in nothing in a robe. He peeks through the door as she changes out of her towel into her robe. And, you know, he's like, come on, and maybe we could get together. I'm like, ew. I mean, does this work on anybody, John? Come on.
He doesn't understand the concept of personal space.
No, absolutely not. Well, weirdly enough, though, after she pretty much kicks him out of the room, she actually seems to sort of, I don't know, feel bad for doing it and heads out in the hall to go to his room and apologize or to make up or something. But she notices that the ghoul is coming up the stairs. So she runs back into her room and locks the door. Someone comes to the door, but she's surprised to find it's just Mrs. Thomas, who passed absolutely nobody in the hallway. The next morning, creepy John arrives with some coffee, and they get good and buddy-buddy. These are kind of little examples of the fact that poor Mary is not – she's a damaged woman in more ways than one, I think.
Yes.
She definitely has some intimacy issues and issues with just getting close with people, period, even on a platonic level.
Yeah.
And she feels like she has to, even though John is like the creepiest and worst guy to actually get cozy with at all, I think she actually convinces herself that she should, just because, you know, because she wants to be more human, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah, she's lonely and she needs someone to talk to.
Yeah, and it's pretty much anybody, whoever happens to be there. Unfortunately, it's John.
Yeah.
Well, Mary apparently has the whole day off, so she goes to do some dress shopping. So we see her at the department store trying a couple things on. And again, you know, this is just a little thing. I don't think they still do it anymore, but I remember the days in the department stores where you used to hear all the ding-dings over the speakers. Do you guys remember that?
No, I'm about a decade younger than you, so I'm just kidding. I don't recall that, though. I thought you were going to go to the bit about her getting her dress hemmed, and you could only still get that done in, you know, Nordstrom's and, you know, high-end department stores. So,
well, there is some fantastic customer service in this film. I mean, a gas station attendant. She doesn't have to get out of her car. He just automatically comes out to fill it up and wipes the window down for her and everything. And then
I think that's interesting. I mean, about this movie, everybody is so friendly and nice, with the exception of Creeper.
Yeah.
And by the way, I figured out who it was. It's Pete Campbell in Mad Men. He's such a creepy guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Those who watch it, yeah, they remind me of each other. But almost everybody in this movie is like ultra nice, which is, you know, totally in opposition. I have to think it's a direction choice, because she's so closed off from everybody, and everybody else is, you know, almost everybody else is just really friendly, except for, of course, the one creepy guy.
While changing, we see a little ripple effect over the screen, and suddenly the world goes silent. The only sound that you can hear is Mary trying to speak to people who don't seem to notice that she even exists, and you hear the sounds of her footsteps. The rest of the world is completely silent. And I thought, you know, there was probably... If you watch it really closely and really listen, I'm sure there was some errors, but I thought it was actually done really well. Obviously, this sound, her speaking and her footsteps had to be done in post.
Yeah.
And I still think it actually comes off really well, certainly for 1962, to try something of this level. I don't know. Sometimes when I say that, when I say things like of this time, you know, 1960s, maybe they were a little bit better in filmmaking than I really give them credit for. Barry, you might be able to speak to this more better than I am.
I could just say that French filmmakers, at this point, we're definitely doing stuff like that, really kind of innovative film techniques. The example that comes to mind, obviously, is Diabolique, the movie that really inspired Psycho. But you're right, in terms of American filmmaking, this was a pretty radical film, and it's funny that we recognize this now. When it came out, it was kind of just this, you know, this B-movie drive-in curiosity. And now we look at this movie and we really see, yeah, there's a lot here for all the things about this movie that are quaint and small. There's a great deal here that a lot of other filmmakers utilize, and even you could even say improved upon. But in many cases, as Lydia mentioned, I mean, the subtleties of this movie that are really intriguing, because it's a wildly stylish movie. But one of the more endearing things about it is it doesn't seem like they're trying very hard. They're trusting that the mood and the creepiness of it is going to work you over, and it does.
Well, Mary runs outside to still a silent world. No noise from the cars passing by. No one on the street seems to give her any notice. And finally, when she's pretty much at her wit's end at this, she's at the park and she's under a tree and she begins to hear a bird chirp. And then slowly, the rest of the world, all the sound kind of comes back. She thinks she sees the ghoul, and she ends up running right into the arms of a one Dr. Samuels, who politely offers to help her. Once again, as Lydia is saying, everyone is so friendly.
That is one of the things that struck me about this movie, is that I think it's even beyond this era. I think that they're making a point with it.
Well, after a discussion with the doctor, who's not a psychiatrist, but he wants to help. So I don't know what kind of doctor he is exactly. But after a brief discussion with him, Mary decides
to... lonely kind.
Yeah.
He wants to play doctor with Mary.
I wasn't even going there.
Yeah, we find out he's John's brother. No. No.
You're a very strong-willed person, aren't you?
I survived, that's what you mean.
That old pavilion out by the lake. Somehow you associate it with all this, don't you?
I could go out there. Could put an end to that, too. I could go out
now there. Don't be hasty.
If it is all my imagination, I could put a stop to it.
Maybe, but at least someone should be with you. Now, I can't possibly get away now.
As you say, Doctor, I'm a person of strong will. And the time to go out there is now. And if I have to, I can go alone.
And she gets there, and she does. She goes and explores, but really only finds empty rooms and empty rides, although there was a couple odd things that did happen, a couple things moved without anyone there. But other than that, she appears to be alone, and there's nothing there, nothing to it. She heads back home, and John is there being his usual pushy self and pretty much gives her no choice but to go out with him after work the next day, I guess it is, or maybe later that night.
Ladies, I just want to take a moment and... Yeah, you're never this lonely. You're just never that lonely. If you're that lonely, call one of your girlfriends, you know.
At the church while playing the organ, Mary seems to go into a little bit of a daydream or a trance, and she begins playing some very strange and haunting music. And in this state, she kind of sees, she has a vision or a dream of the ghoul, or some ghouls rising out of the water and having a nice dance out at the old carnival.
Profane, sacrilege! What are you playing in this church? Have you no respect? Do you feel no reverence? And I feel sorry for you and your lack of soul. This organ, the music of this church, these things have meaning and significance to us. I assume they did to you. But without this awareness, I'm afraid you cannot be our organist. In conscience, I must ask you to resign.
Apparently, it's a very tightly run church.
We're all biting our tongues over here.
I swear, there's so much to say about her and her decisions. I feel like everything is kind of illuminated by the ending, and I don't want to jump on your description of the story.
Well, I'm hoping I'm not hacking it up.
No.
Well, Mary, despite just getting canned, walks outside. John's waiting for her, lucky her. And she shows they go on her date, which goes about as well as can be expected by us, the viewer.
I think better, honestly. She does not get date raped, so it does go better than we expect it to go.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that statement right there? He doesn't murder her, so it's a successful date.
Pretty much.
That's right.
No, I expected her to live, you know, through the date. So, maybe have to run to the police or something.
Well, maybe we should say that she doesn't get date raped yet.
Oh,
it may have been in the cards for John. He does take her home and does manage to get into her room. And things seem to be going in his direction when suddenly Mary sees the ghoul again in the mirror. And she tries to tell John what's going on. And he decides, you know what? He doesn't want to get messed up with some crazy dame. And leaves the room.
Again,
yeah,
ladies.
Suddenly she's the bad one.
Again, ladies, if you ever find yourself in a position where you are getting unwanted attention, you know, pretending to be crazy is sometimes helpful.
Yeah.
I've heard.
I just think it's funny. As pushy as this guy has been, I'm guessing he doesn't really put a lot of stock in, you know, whether if they're crazy or not. Pretty much, are they breathing and do they have two legs?
Oh,
good.
Well,
all right, fine.
One leg would be okay for him.
But honestly.
I did want to take a moment to point out, I love whenever you see the ghoulish guy, it's always kind of a flash. You know, you get the impression for her, at least, that it's like something you see out of the corner of your eye. It's I hate to pull this in, but the episode of Doctor Who with the family of blood, you know, and the little girl in the mirror. Ah, so creepy, creepy. But I feel like they do this really well, where you get the idea that for her, even though we're seeing it, you know, as an outside person, you know, you get the idea that she sees this reflection and it freaks her out. And then she looks again and it's herself. You know, and the first time that happens, I think, in the boarding house, she kind of laughs it off. But it gets creepier, I think. I think it is creepier in this movie because it's something that happens to everybody. We all, you know, think we see something move in the mirror and then go, oh, it was actually just me walking by the mirror. It was something, you know, hanging behind me in a reflection. But I think, you know, if you watch this movie late enough at night and by yourself enough, then you really start seeing those similarities.
You know, I think at this point, when she sees him too, you know, John's getting up cozy behind her and goes to, like, I think kiss her neck. And that's when she looks up and suddenly it's the ghoul, pretty much leaning in for a little kiss or something like that. I mean, it is a quick shot. And then she turns and it's John again. And it's done so well that honestly, if the audience watching it blinked, they could miss it.
Yeah. And again, I love it because, I mean, you really, even though we as the audience, well, we can see it for a little bit longer period of time for every time she sees it. And I think this might actually be an indicator of her acting abilities that I honestly missed watching this twice. But like really thinking about it, she, you know, every time that happens, it's always her seeing it very quickly and reacting very fast to mm-hmm. making that eye line, you know.
Yeah.
And it is creepy.
Well, Mary, having lost her job and everything, Miss Thompson, I think, even mentions that she can't stay in the house. Apparently, you know, word travels fast. I don't know what the minister has been saying. Between the minister and the doctor, who also shows up at the boarding house, word has gotten around that Mary is just not right in the head or something. There's something wrong with Mary.
there's something about Mary.
There's something about Mary. Thank you. Boy, there was a joke I was going for.
Oh, see, I thought you were just, you know, I didn't realize.
No, I was. I was trying to reach for it. And like, as I'm talking, I'm thinking, you know, I actually don't know.
Something about Mary.
Oh, something about Mary. That's it. So she packs up. She's leaving. She packs her bag, gets in her car, drives off. Before she leaves, she does take one more stop up at the, to the carnival. And, once there, she's confronted again by these ghouls who rise out of the water. There's a bunch more ghouls rising out of the water for, again, more dancing. And finally, they spot her. And this is – tell me if you guys noticed this or not. Did they speed the film up just slightly as the ghouls run after her?
Yes.
And that initial shot when they're dancing – and she's—I don't remember if she screams or they just notice her. Suddenly, they run after her, and I swear the film speeds up just enough to make it just a little bit inhuman.
Yes, it's a very unsettling effect.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very, very cool. I loved it. I think I actually out loud just went like, oh, that was nice.
Honestly, through the whole kind of dance bit there, it's you've got a lot of creepy camera angles. It's a very creepy effect. It's a lot of, you know, kind of first person dancing with these ghouls. And it's mm-hmm. I keep coming back to the word creepy because I think it's.
Well, it's a word that fits
really
well. It really does, yeah.
Well, it's scary because these ghouls are making eye contact with us in our eye line.
Well, Mary runs from the ghouls. They run after her. It almost seems like a game for the ghouls. They seem to be almost playing with her.
And one thing I want to point out is in that scene, it is her as a ghoul dancing with the ghoul guy. And
is it?
It is. And I had to watch it. I mean, the second time I watched it, I was like, wait a minute, that is her.
Yeah.
And she's.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. It's. And I think that's when she sees that. And I think that's when she screams as she realizes it's her as a ghoul.
Gotcha.
But again, you know, to see yourself in that situation and realize that it's you. Very, very creepy.
Well, they end up running after her. They run off into the beach and she stumbles and falls in the sand and the ghouls all surround her. And at that point, the screen goes blank, and next we see we're back to the river, and they have finally found the car, and they pull the car up out of the water, and all three girls are still in the car, including Mary.
Dun, dun.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Mary is now wearing the outfit that she was wearing when we saw her running from the ghouls. That is not the same outfit that she was wearing when she crashed in the car.
So now I'm going to hold on. I'm fast forwarding. You said clothes. Now I have to know.
I'm pretty sure she is wearing some sort of flowered blouse in the beginning.
She is. She's wearing a flowered dress at the very beginning.
Yep. And at the end, when they pull her out, she is wearing her. Well, it's hard to tell. It's black and white, but it's a plain color, some sort of tweed outfit.
So wait, they didn't actually pull her out.
They didn't pull her out, but you do see her sitting there in the car, and I'm pretty sure she is wearing like the tweed jacket or top or whatever coat that she was wearing in the final scene and not the flower dress.
That's just spooky.
Yep, absolutely. Or as Lydia put it,
you're right.
Creepy.
It is. Well, it looks like a solid color dress to me.
Yep.
So I think you're right. I think she's wearing the different outfit. Well, I mean, yeah. You have all these people interacting with her the whole time, so that's a question. I can,
yes.
Honestly, I didn't make that link to The Sixth Sense, but now that, yeah. Now, yeah.
And there you go. That's the Carnival of Souls in a nutshell. I have really glossed. This is a visual movie. I mean, I can give you plot points and tell you what happened in the film, but it is a very visual film.
Yeah, as far as the storyline goes, it's very simple.
Very much. And yeah, exactly. And this is also one of those films that I was sitting there thinking as I was watching it. This is one of those films that can only be in black and white. I cannot imagine this film being shot in color.
Mm-hmm.
It would definitely detract a lot from the effect of it.
I don't know if it was always intentional or not, but there were some moments where it was so black and white at times where it just seemed like that the blacks were almost disappearing into the screen. You know, the suit, the black jacket that the ghoul was wearing just sometimes would seem so black to almost being not there.
Well, and that lends a lot to it. You do have a much more phantasmic result
mm-hmm.
from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you would lose that if it were in color.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a rich, soupy black and white. I mean, you're right. It seems like there's a real thickness of darkness in the film. One of the things I love to describe to my students who go, I don't like black and white. And I get that. I understand that. Most of us aren't, you know, didn't grow up with black and white. But I love black and white. And this is something I always love to say. It takes away from the distraction of beauty. Beauty would have been a real distraction for this movie. But the black and white makes all the characters, all their emotions, all their actions seem very stark. It seems like this creepy alternate universe that we're looking at. And one of my favorite things about this film is that Mary's journey, even though it's a supernatural one for obvious reasons, you can look at this film another way and say, this is what it's like to be stalked. This is what it's like for a young woman to feel like she is always watched, always judged, always being stalked by someone.
Mm, yeah, very much. Interesting.
I've never been stalked, so.
Oh, you have. I mean, oh, really?
Mm. Not that I'm aware of.
It just gets creepier and creepier.
In carrying with the theme of the movie.
The special Halloween episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we really picked the wrong
month for this. Maybe we should save this one till October.
Yeah. Going back to something you mentioned, Barry, the whole how Candace carries herself through this film with just this sort of deadpanned look on her face, and as you put it, as the life being sucked out of her. Yeah, it works incredibly well because we find out that the entire time she is essentially dead and she is just sleepwalking through her life. It just worked so well. I don't know. It's such so unfortunate that this director went on to do no other feature films. I mean, this was his one. I guess he tried it. It didn't really work for him. He just went back to doing more educational films and stuff. And I wish there was like a repertoire of films for this man that you could go back and decide whether or not that was intentional.
Yeah, likewise. I wish Herc Harvey had done more films. And by the way, Herc Harvey is the man playing the ghoul. That's him.
Oh,
wow. Oh, fantastic. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's him in that creepy white makeup. Now, we mentioned before about how the side characters in this film, John excluded, have this uber friendliness. And I think it reflects maybe the fact that Herc Harvey is from Lawrence, Kansas. He's a small town guy. And this movie kind of reflects old school small town values. In a sense, you could even say that small towns still have this quality of people who tend to be, either very friendly or very nosy or very inquisitive. Yep.
I have to say, I was in Kansas 2 weeks ago for a business trip, and it was bizarre how nice everybody was. And this is, 2014. And I went into, the hotel and everybody's like, oh, hi, and you're like, but they're not like superficially high like they are here where I live. They were just legitimately friendly and helpful. And it was just, and I didn't think about that after I left Kansas until just now when you mentioned it. And yeah, that's exactly, it feels like Kansas.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's fun. Like I said, I love independent films, mainly for the reason that we're talking right here is that they're usually shot with all local talent. Very rarely does an independent filmmaker have the budget to hire in a quote-unquote, Hollywood actor. So they go to local production, stage production troupes, and find their actors or just find friends and family. And so, I mean, this film was all shot in that way. And I just really appreciate that. I love that about independent films. And to find that kind of stuff going on even in the 1960s and being done as well as this one, it was a really great surprise. And it just made it enjoyable watch.
I don't think there's anybody – usually you have in a low-budget film, you have at least one or two characters that – stick out as, oh, that's a person that they, said, oh, yeah, you can be in it because they're pretty and obviously awful actor or something like that. You really don't run into that with this movie.
No, you really don't. That's a good point. There is no over actors. Mm-hmm. Everyone does a really great job. There's no one that steps in and does the big pose for the camera and, hi, I'm Bob.
Right, exactly. You don't have anybody saying, oh, look over there. That's the classic. It's just awful acting. But in this case, you really don't. I'm a big proponent of that being, chalked up to the director because I've seen, we've all seen movies with actors that we know can really perform and they do an awful job and you know that it's the director's fault. So, I think the opposite to this or the opposite to that is this movie where you can tell that the director knew what he wanted. And I think he got it.
If I can find out who it was edited by, if there was any other names I'd recognize or would know by, here's film editing, Bill Desjardins, Dan Palmquist and Herbert Strock. the editor, this is his only film. It's like, why are these people, why is this their only film? It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Really, really odd and just impressive group of people.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Almost creepy in and of itself.
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, Skype wasn't too kind, and we lost Barry during this conversation, so he will not be joining us for our sign-offs here. So I will just ask Lydia if you had any closing thoughts on Carnival of Souls.
I think we had mentioned it, that I watched it a couple of times, and I kind of – you're gonna despise me. It didn't capture me as much as it should have. As much as I should say, I probably didn't get involved in it as much as I should have done. But talking to you guys about it actually, I think, highlighted a lot of the values in it that I didn't really appreciate with the first time I watched it. So if you know, I know Christopher said at the beginning of this that, hey, you know, if you haven't seen it yet, stop it and watch it. But if you've already watched it and, you know, listen to all this, go back and watch it again. I think it adds to the experience. You know, every time I talk to you, Christopher and Barry, then, you know, I get more out of a movie than I did before, which is why I love doing this. But but I think, you know, even if you have already seen it, after talking about what you've talked about and Barry's talked about, going back and watching it again, you know, because as I mentioned, I've got it running on one of my screens in here. It's interesting to see what you guys are talking about and really appreciate the value to it more than I did otherwise. So much more enjoyable movie than I first gave it credit for.
Oh, well, good. Well, I'm glad you ended up enjoying it.
Yeah, I know that sounds awful, but it, you know, I didn't research it beforehand, which I probably should have done. But, you know, knowing more about it increases my appreciation for it.
Yep. Oh, and I know exactly what you mean. I've done the same thing listening to other – I listen to a lot of podcasts, and many of those podcasts, they review television show episodes, movies, what have you. And even on movies or television episodes or whatever that I've watched, I'm like, yeah, it was okay. I didn't really care for it. I'll hear people talk, and they have done the research.
Right.
They know about this. They know about, oh, this was a choice by this and that, or this was a callback to this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Really,
I like that.
Yeah, no one person can hold all that knowledge in their head. And so I love the opportunity to get to talk to you guys about this, because you really – you find out so much, not just specifically you and not us, not just specifically this podcast, but talking to people who are, you know, passionate about that and really see the value and know the history. It always makes it a more enjoyable experience.
Absolutely. No, and this is a really great film, and a film that I think would be fun to do in a group watch, honestly, mm-hmm. where you could sit and kind of quietly discuss it as you were watching it, and maybe even, you know, as something happens, sort of give it a pause and say, okay, now look at that.
Yeah.
What do you think of this? How cool is that? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so great. If you're in a film club, if you're doing video, especially, I think it's, you know, in college I studied video or, you know, recording arts, and you know, obviously we always had to go out and make our own video, our own film. And this is, I think, a really great example of what you can do with simple understatement. Subtlety is so much more powerful a lot of the time.
Well, then, I think that's going to do it for this month of February. I want to thank my brave and hopefully un-ghoul-like co-hosts. Of course, we don't know about Barry. He's gone.
Yeah, the ghoul might have
taken
got him.
From us here. Yeah.
Oh, no.
A very special thanks to our listeners. I hope you continue to download future episodes of Orphan Entertainment. You, of course, can easily do that by subscribing to the iTunes feed. And while you're there, please give us a rating and leave a comment for us. 5 stars are great. We love stars.
I love stars.
If you would like to get in touch with us with any suggestions, comments, or general feedback, you can best do that by joining our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/orphanentertainment. And don't worry, I'll have that link in the show notes. So thanks very much again for listening. Thank you, Lydia, for joining me. Thank you, Barry. I'm sorry you got knocked off.
Barry. Thank you, Christopher.
Oh, absolutely. So goodbye, everyone, until next time. And remember, beware the ghoul.
Yeah. Thank you.